In cultivating these perceptions, of impermanent, unreliable, not self. The power of that is not just because it's kind of cool to see these things, but because of the power of that seeing to release the mind from clinging, to free the mind from suffering. In one sutta, there's a description in particular connecting to the seeing of impermanence, how that follows on to freedom. And in this case, exploration of impermanence in relationship to the five aggregates. Form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, volitional formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. Seeing this, one experiences disenchantment towards form, disenchantment towards feeling, disenchantment towards perception, disenchantment towards volitional formation, disenchantment towards consciousness. Experiencing disenchantment, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes to be the knowledge. It's liberated. One understands what's had to be done has been done. So this kind of following on from the seeing of impermanence, it doesn't just stop there. It points to how the seeing of impermanence creates conditions in the mind to become disenchanted with experience. That disenchantment leads to what's called dispassion. And that dispassion to freedom, to release. So I thought to take some time to explore these words. Disenchantment, dispassion, and a little bit about freedom. So the word disenchantment, it's a translation of Pali Nibbida. And it's translated in different ways. Sometimes it's translated as revulsion or disgust. But to me, disenchantment feels like a more evocative sense of this space where our kind of, this is where we begin to see through, seeing clearly in the impermanent nature of experience, the unreliable nature of experience, the not-self nature of experience. The mind begins to become, realize it has been enchanted. It has been under the thrall of these misperceptions of permanent, reliable, controllable, self. So the disenchantment is kind of about recognizing that the ways in which we have been held in thrall, the ways in which we've been enchanted by our the usual ways of relating to the world, we begin to see they're not so useful. It's that kind of clearing of the vision. These things that seem to be so helpful. My mind had been weaving this web of, this is what makes you happy. And it's a very sticky web. Opening deeply to impermanence, we see the unreliable nature of experience. We begin to see that the belief connected to that, the belief that we think things are reliable, we begin to see through that, and also kind of see through a belief that I need to hold on to things. Kind of this belief that somehow the holding on, the clinging helps me. So the seeing of the impermanence pointing to these truths of unreliable, not self. We start to see this disenchantment, the mind seeing the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. We start to see that there's not actually anything to hold on to. Witnessing this process of our body and mind really just deeply taking in its nature, we find that the experience of clinging, of holding on, is a mental activity. And that mental activity is kind of launched into existence, or launched into its happening because of a belief that holding on is going to somehow make me happy. We start to see this phenomenon of clinging as a phenomenon. So we see that this suffering, we begin to experience the kind of the tightness, the tension around the clinging. We feel that and recognize, yeah, that's dukkha. And we begin to recognize that's mind made. Begin to see, at times we begin to see the mind let go of it and realize that that clinging is optional. It's not a necessary way to be in relationship to experience. And so we see that that clinging is just another construct of the mind. We might also begin to see, as we observe what the mind thinks it's finding reliability in, what it's clinging to, that that experience or thing that we're clinging to is also made up by the mind. Because what's only ever happening is just this unreliable phenomenon, this impermanent phenomenon coming and going at actually a pretty rapid pace. And so when we are clinging to something, and you can check this out, when there is clinging, if you get curious, what am I clinging to? what is actually being held on to. It's an idea that we're holding on to. It's a concept. An idea of perhaps a certain thing or a certain state, a certain idea. If I'm this kind of person, then I'll be happy. If people think this about me, then I'll be happy. If I have this kind of stuff around me, then I'll be happy. It's all concept that the mind clings to. It actually can't cling to this impermanent, unreliable phenomenon. But the mind kind of stabilizes. One of the functions of our perceptual function, the perceptual capacity of our mind, is to kind of stabilize our experience in a way so that we can navigate the world. But we mistake that stabilization for the reliability. And the mind then kind of latches on to a concept, which is something the mind can put up into place and repeat kind of for a series of moments, creating the illusion of some kind of permanence. And that's what the mind clings to, are those concepts and ideas. And so and those concepts and ideas are, they're just these little like fleeting, like they're also, you know, just blips in the mind. And so what we are clinging to is also just a construct of the mind. So seeing this, the mind gets disillusioned by this process of clinging. It begins to recognize, yeah, this is not apparently where happiness is found. And so this process of disenchantment starts. Bhikkhu Bodhi describes one way to describe this experience of disenchantment. Again, the word nibbida. He uses the word nibbida in his paragraph. So he says, nibbida signifies, in short, the serene, dignified withdrawal from phenomena, which supervenes when the illusion of their permanence, reliability, and selfhood has been shattered by the light of correct knowledge and vision of things as they are. In my own experience and in the getting to witness the process of many, many people, this place of disenchantment is often not such a feeling of serene, dignified withdrawal. It feels much more bumpy than that. Our minds do not like these truths, and the process of disenchantment seems to go about by bumping into the ways that we just completely, like the deepest recesses of our being, scream, no, it is not okay that things are impermanent. It's not okay that things are unreliable. And so this process of becoming disenchanted, we go through many relationships to these truths. Relationships to the seeing of impermanent, the seeing of unreliable, sometimes the seeing of not self, although often the experience of the seeing of not self has much more of that quality of the serene, dignified withdrawal. It's more like, oh yeah. It's almost a feeling of relief in a way. But the mind goes through quite a bit as it meets at deeper and deeper levels these truths of impermanent and unreliable. So lots of seemingly emotional flavors to seeing these truths. And I think this is, these emotional tones are connected to the deeper ways that we cling. The deeper ways our being does not like, does not want these truths to be true. So the framing or the use of the word, the translation of nibbida as disgust or revulsion, sometimes that can be the relationship as we really touch into this impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. It's just like, really? It's like this? Just this disgusted feeling. Or sometimes it can have a little bit of a feeling of, it's like, yeah, oh, there's nothing here for me. You know, do I really have to sit here and keep experiencing, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching? It's like this sense of, yeah, enough already. So all of these experiences, these relationships need to be recognized. The path essentially through this place of becoming unhooked, of becoming disenchanted, this seeing through the ways in which our mind is enchanted. Essentially, I think these emotional relationships are like those pointers to seeing through some of the ways that we are enchanted. And so the seeing of those relationships is just beginning to recognize, yes, this is what the mind is doing. This is how the mind is relating. It is seeing effectively some of the deeper clingings around these truths. This is the instruction I said the other day that Steve Armstrong gave me. Notice your relationship to dukkha. And this is what it refers to. Notice how you are with the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. Just kind of forcing yourself to be with, yep, it's impermanent. Oh, wow, this feels awful. Not knowing that this feels awful piece. We are still caught. Trying to force ourselves to stay with the, somehow thinking that staying with the impermanent, that's where it's going to like reveal something to us. The clinging is being revealed in the relationship to that impermanent, unreliable experience. So many different relationships can happen with this. There can be a kind of a sense of overwhelm at times. Just overwhelmed by seeing impermanence, seeing sometimes such a rapidity of change. Just the mind in this place of can't keep up. Trying to keep up, the feeling of how can I possibly keep up with this? That's a relationship. A feeling of overwhelm or fear sometimes about the experience. A feeling of dread can be there at times. I remember in Burma at times walking to the meditation hall and just this rising sense of dread coming. And that's actually the moment when Steve's instruction appeared in my mind. Oh, right, this is what I'm supposed to notice, the dread. Okay, dread. Dread is what's happening. This dread that I'm not going to be able to see everything, this dread that it's going to be so rapidly changing, this going to have this feeling of nowhere to land. So the relationship being an important seeing for us. Sometimes the relationship can be kind of a feeling of homesickness, almost like longing for the delusion to come back. You know, like, yeah, that felt all cozy and comfy when I was in my deluded state, and I can't see it that way anymore. And there's a feeling of kind of like wishing I could bring back that cozy, comfy delusion so that I didn't have to see this truth. So that homesickness or that feeling can be a piece of this flavor. Sometimes it can be boredom, as we just see. It is just endless. Seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, things in the mind. Sometimes it feels like, can't somebody turn this channel off? Sometimes there can be a sense of real disinterest coming up. Feeling of like, again, connected to this. It's maybe a more connected or a more present experience that could slip into boredom. But just like, yeah, there's stuff is happening and the mind is just like, yeah, okay, it's happening, but boy, there is just no interest here to observe this, to know this. If your mind happens to be a particularly curious type of mind, this space can be very uncomfortable because that curiosity, you know, that curiosity of, oh yeah, wow, it's so cool to look at all these things happening, that goes away and it feels like something is wrong. It feels like I must not be practicing right if there's not that curiosity. Noticing the disinterest. Disinterest in what's happening is what's happening right now. Sometimes it's even like not wanting to practice comes up. One of my teachers, when talking about this to one of my teachers, he said, "Well, okay, try to stop practicing." Like that doesn't work, Sayadaw. But that wish, that urge, that's like not wanting to practice, just again, just noticing that not wanting to practice is arising. What a relief! The mind, in seeing that thought or that wish to want to stop practicing, felt almost betrayed by the mind. It felt like betrayed. It kind of thought initially, it was kind of like, well, either I have to stop practicing because this thought arose and it's telling me to do that, or believe that I shouldn't practice. You know, just somehow that this being caught in this belief that I had to convince myself not to believe it. Either I had to stop or had to convince myself to not believe it anymore. Those were the only two options I could fathom until this kind of arising of, oh, not wanting to practice is arising. Cuts right between those two. Oh, that's what's happening. Not wanting to practice. So these different flavors of relationship to experience can happen, you know, in many different ways and times throughout our practice. They can be connected with this real deepening of practice in this place of disenchantment. But they can also be connected to, you know, seeings of impermanence, unreliable at all phases of the path. And so again, really, this teaching of Sayadaw to notice the relationship to experience is so powerful. And at this point in the practice, as the mind really starts to head towards disenchantment, the noticing of the relationships is the way the practice deepens. It doesn't deepen by trying to stay with the impermanence. It deepens by noticing the wish it weren't so, the boredom, the disinterest, the fear, the terror, the dread, the overwhelm. I name these things partly because, we stumble into things like this, and often we think we're making a mistake. We've made a mistake. It's a problem. We're not practicing properly when these things happen in our mind. There are times in our practice when the overwhelm is more connected to the psychological realm than the deepening Dharma realm. But wherever it's happening, it's useful to notice, oh, overwhelm is happening. Or fear is happening in relationship to experience. And that also is a place, how the practice deepens. Wherever the relationship is seen, whatever level or stage, wherever we are in the practice, when we see how our mind is relating to something, when there's greed, aversion, delusion in that relationship, that right there, that is the place of the clinging. That is the place where the mind is stuck. And so noticing these relationships. Our practice deepens through opening to these relationships. And so then the mind moves in this direction of the next word in this paragraph was dispassion. Dispassion may have a flavor in our minds. The word may resonate as disconnected or pulled back, something like that. But this quality is basically the letting go of the passions that it's letting go of are the passions around greed, aversion, and delusion. It is not letting go. I mean, another word that has this root passion in it is compassion. And dispassion does not mean no compassion. In fact, just the opposite. As the heart releases its passion around greed, aversion, and delusion, it more easily opens to connectedness, love, responsiveness in the world, care. When seeing suffering happening, compassion arises. The movement towards alleviating that suffering happens through the dispassion. It's the decoupling from the usual ways our mind is passionate. The passion connected with greed, aversion, and delusion. So the word in Pali for this word, viraga, has a flavor of the literal translation I understand is something like fading away. It's apparently used in connection with cloths that are dyed, brightly colored cloths that are dyed, and as they're placed out in the sun, the color fades. And this is the word that's used to describe that, this fading of the brightly colored dye. And so the word itself evokes a gradual process, not a kind of a, you know, one-shot boom. And as, you know, I reflected last night on some of the the similes that the Buddha offers for the gradual nature of the path. One, the rotting of a rope that's left on a beach from a shipwreck, and the way that the sun, the sand, the wind, the waves just gradually, slowly wear away at that rope. Each day, if you go, you're not going to see much change in the rope, but over the course of months, it will wear away. And he compares the path of practice to this kind of gradual wearing away. He says that the sun, the sand, the wind, the waves are like mindfulness and wisdom working on our greed, aversion, and delusion. So this very gradual kind of movement. And then there can be a kind of a sudden experience like that simile of gills, where it's like suddenly, poof, something seems radically different. That chopping of wood, moment after moment, nothing seems much different, and suddenly, poof, it splits. So that experience, that moment of that splitting or that releasing can have a sense of suddenness, of startle to it. But the whole process leading up to that is very gradual and happens gradually. So we see two, we can see a part of this gradual process at various levels at different times, seeing through certain things. We may see a fading away of an attachment, or maybe even a quick, like, seeing through some attachment, seeing like, wow, that doesn't make any sense, and our mind just realizes that doesn't make any sense to cling to. And it's like so obvious. Why would I cling to that ever again? This kind of sense of, oh, I got that now. Won't cling to that again. But the delusion is quite powerful and comes back. And so even seeing a kind of a fading or attachment or a releasing of an attachment at one point doesn't mean that it won't come back. And so sometimes this is part of the way that it's a gradual fading. It's kind of like in and out, in and out, in and out. It's not a mistake that it happens in this way. Earlier today in one of the groups, exploring this kind of process of having seen through something, and not recognizing that the insight is impermanent. It's kind of like, well, how can I trust the mind then? You know, how do I know what's trustable? And I kind of have the sense that when there are insights, we talked about this in the delusion, when I talked about delusion. So when there are insights, when there is an understanding, the mind has seen something clearly. And then when the delusion comes back, because it has seen the non-delusion, it can now recognize that's delusion. And that's a form of wisdom. That is the wisdom connected to that seeing. It may not be quite the conditions of the wisdom that can arise and obliterate that delusion in that moment. But there is an ability to see that delusion, and that is that wisdom at work. And so it's not completely gone. It's not like yes, the insights are impermanent. The conditions for the experiencing that clear seeing, that space of really understanding and seeing through that delusion, that may not be present in this moment. But the kind of the there's been this workings in the mind, conditioning the mind in the direction of wisdom. So in one of the groups this morning, I used this analogy of just thinking about the way our mental formations work, our greed, aversion, delusion, our frustration, our anger, you know, all of these things come in and get very deeply conditioned. They're strong. They kind of impel the mind in a particular direction, and those are like grooves in the mind. It's the Buddha's term for it. So, but we see sometimes that they're there. Sometimes they're not there. You know, they're there. Sometimes they're not there. Sometimes, and when they're not there, they're not functioning. But there still is this kind of underlying tendency for those patterns, those things that we've worn deep grooves about. There's an underlying tendency for them to come up. But when they're not coming up, that underlying tendency pattern is not like being evoked. It's not happening. There's a kind of an understanding of the way the brain works with the way, you know, it's just a, you know, normal process of the way the neurons work is when there's some kind of pattern that the neurons experience, you know, some repeated pattern. It's like what happens in that case, so I understand from my little neuropsychology, neurobiology reading and study, as those patterns get evoked, as those patterns happen, it's like the neurons, they're simply these machines that say, oh, this one must be important, let's attach more neurons to this pattern. So anything that's kind of repeated will get shored up. These neurons will shore things up. And then there's kind of like more entryways into the pattern. That kind of, so there's like more ways that we can get into it, and it gets stronger and stronger. And so when that pattern is happening, you're feeling the results of that. That's the experience of that arising. We know that it's present. We feel the effects of it. When that's not happening, when that pattern is not being engaged, in our mind, while it's the tendency is there, you know, and again, here this is in the brain. While the tendency is there in the brain for that pattern to come up again, right in this moment, it is not experienced. This is the non-arising of that pattern. And yet there still is this underlying tendency, this potentiality, we could say, a potential for that to happen. What seems to happen with wisdom as it's seen, so the seeing of that insight, it seems to kind of, and now I'm going to just leave off the brain at this point, because like I have no idea how this works, because it seems to me like the whole way that it's described, that the neurons shore things up and come together, it's like it's a gradual process, that kind of thing happening. But when wisdom arises, it can feel like those patterns are just kind of like obliterated sometimes. So there's something about the way that the wisdom, the understanding works, that it creates a very like rapid underlying tendency towards that wisdom. This is just my kind of trying to make sense of this. Those insights, those understandings create a kind of a substrate of the mind tending in the direction of that wisdom in the future. And it somehow seems in some ways more potent conditioning than the conditioning of delusion. I don't know how or why that is so, but it seems to have more potency to it. So those insights that we have when we experience a deep understanding, and it's like, oh, this is so obvious. It's like an underlying tendency to that wisdom has been laid down. And it's not always operating. The delusion, the momentum of greed, aversion, and delusion can come back. But it's not. It's like the conditioning power of wisdom is still in the stream, even if it's not arising right in this moment. So this speaks to, you know, some of the way that the conditioning works. You know, a lot of the conditioning we've spoken about does seem to be, you know, in this moment, the next moment, we see this way that this thing conditions, the next thing conditions, the next thing. And that's a lot of what we do see. But there's also a form of conditioning that seems to come. It arises in the moment based on something that happened long ago. And this is encapsulated in the dependent origination piece, in that part I talked about the other morning, the mental formations can be formations that have momentum from years ago. Something arises in the mind in this moment that like connects back to something that happened before we could even speak. And whoop, that mental formation or that kind of conditioning is now affecting the present moment. So likewise with the wisdom. You know, when that wisdom is there, it has been seen. It's not like it's, again, it's not like it's there as an entity, like something you can pick up and pull out, but it is this potentiality. It's in the stream, in this stream of our conditioning. And it's a very powerful force in our stream of conditioning, this wisdom, when those moments of wisdom happen. And they come and go. And so this is slow fading, you know. It's not quite so like gradual in the way that the fading of a cloth happens. You know, it's almost more like you've got this cloth sitting out there fading in the sun, and somebody comes along and throws more dye on it. You know? It's like, okay. And then it starts to fade some more. So this fading process, we could also connect to in another sense realm. You know, maybe the fading of a sound. I'm going to ring the bell and just connect with the sound of the bell and hear how it fades and rises and fades and rises. This is a similar kind of way that this fading happens. There's a point in the fading of that sound. It's still there. I'm close enough to it. There's a point in the fading of that sound where it goes below the audible and then reappears and then goes below and reappears. So as it kind of does this fluctuation, and it's the fading of our craving can have that kind of flavor. It disappears and then reappears. It disappears and reappears, fading gradually over time. And over the course of practice, the mind more and more inclines towards this fading, this letting go. And so there's also a letting go aspect of dispassion. So there's the fading piece and the release piece. And this points to freedom. The beginning of recognizing, the seeing of the dispassion, the fading away of greed, aversion, and delusion. The letting go. This is actually a big way that freedom is described, as the letting go, the release, the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. Freedom is not about getting anything. It's about release. The absence of, the release of greed, aversion, delusion, and even maybe more deeply, the non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion. Maybe first, at the beginning, we see these releasings, the mind letting go of some kind of clinging, releasing that, release, release, release. And then we can kind of get hooked to that release sometimes because it feels really good. It feels really good to have that experience of letting go. I told a story in one of the groups this morning that is coming back to me now that feels relevant here. I was doing walking meditation at IMS and noticing how much desire, wanting was arising for looking at people. And initially I was just following the rules and not looking, but that was a kind of a repression, a squashing, a pushing away of the wanting. I was not noticing the wanting, but it happened. And this is a 3-month retreat. It happened for a long enough time that finally it's kind of like in my face. Okay, well, wanting is what's happening. Maybe I should look at that. So started noticing the wanting, springing up, because I tended to try to find places where I could walk, where I didn't see people, because it was such an unpleasant experience to force myself not to look. So I began getting curious about the wanting and saw that as soon as somebody entered my field of vision, my peripheral vision, so I'd be walking and somebody'd pop in from the side and I could just see them in my peripheral vision. And there'd be this kind of pull towards that experience, a pull towards to look at the person. So I'd feel the wanting, that feeling of that like tractor beam pull towards that thing wanted. Strong experience. And then it got stronger as the person would get, you know, further into my field of vision, where it would be much easier to look at them without letting anybody know I was looking at them. Didn't have to turn my head to look at them, but just like a slight little flip of the eyes and I could see who they were. So really strong wanting. And then the person then walking up the stairs, going in the building, and the door closed, and the wanting vanished. So release, that release from that wanting. And this in a very ordinary place, you know, in a very ordinary kind of release, but that feeling of release from the wanting was so profound. So, it's like being released from a vice grip. So much ease in that moment. And then I started like really enjoying seeing that people come into my field of vision, because it was like, I get to see that release. I get to see that go away. I get to feel that cool feeling of release. At some point after another, I don't know, couple weeks of this, I don't know how long this lasted, I realized that I was holding on to the wanting in order to see it let go. And that moment, just like this was a case where the person was in my field of vision, I was wanting and kind of anticipating the moment they would disappear. Like, it's going to happen soon. And in that moment, it was like, oh, I'm holding on to the wanting right now. And in that moment, the mind released the wanting. It had a different quality than the way it released with the, it was the ending of the sight is what ended the wanting in the previous case. In this case, it was just the wanting, the wisdom recognizing this wanting is not necessary. And that actually kind of undermined that whole pattern of wanting to look at people. So that, you know, that kind of sense, we can kind of hold on to that feeling of release. And in this case, it was, it kind of became the appreciation of the non-arising of the wanting. It's a much subtler experience. We tend to like the more visceral kind of things, you know, it's like, oh yeah, let go. Whoa, that feels really good to have that release. The non-arising of wanting is more peaceful. And so we can get a little hooked to that experience of release. And the dispassion moves in the direction of the non-arising. Non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion. Kind of way to maybe feel into this difference. You think back to childhood, think back to something you really, some toy or some item of yours that you really liked as a child. You know, that just seemed so happiness producing at that age. For me, it was my dollhouse. You know, I just really enjoyed the rearranging the furniture and all this stuff and creating scenarios. And as I grew, you know, there was a little bit of less satisfaction with it. You know, it's like I got to be, you know, when I was 7 or 8, I would get friends over and we'd all play together. And then as I got to be like 12 or 13, it's like, it's embarrassing to be playing with my dollhouse at 13. Don't let anybody know this, but, it, you know, so there's still a little bit of this kind of satisfaction happening, but also it's beginning to weaken. It's beginning to, so there's a little bit of this disenchantment. There's a little bit of the kind of weakening of that. So that's when we're starting to recognize it's not as satisfying as it used to be. And it begins to be much more, there's other things that begin to interest the mind. And so, you know, it. And I don't remember when I stopped picking up the dollhouse. You know, it just happened. It faded. It, that, at this age, it's not even, there's, it's like I now think about it in this kind of a situation, but mostly it's like it's not even there. There's no interest at all in thinking about that. It does not arise as a place to find delight or happiness. So you may have something from your own life of that kind of thing, of something that the attachment faded over time, and now it's like it's just not picked up. There's nothing in the mind that would pick it up because it would not provide any satisfaction whatsoever. This is the kind of fading that happens around craving. The mind begins to understand it does not provide the satisfaction it purports to. It does not do that. So our practice asks us to open to the ways in which we hold on to things, for the wisdom to grow that helps the mind to release it. So Bhikkhu Bodhi has another quote. This needs a little bit of description too, some of the language he uses. The term for freedom, nibbana, also sometimes a simile that's used for that is the unconditioned. And to me, this also speaks to the non-arising, essentially, of greed, aversion, delusion. It's like the happiness of freedom is not connected to any arising, not conditioned by an arising. And so there's this term, the unconditioned, and the seeing the happiness that comes from the letting go of this conditioned realm. So here's what he says. The realizing the unconditioned is essentially opening to this freedom. Though the realization of the unconditioned requires a turning away from the conditioned, it must be emphasized that this realization is achieved precisely through the understanding of the conditioned. Nibbana cannot be reached by backing off from a direct confrontation with samsara, the conditioned, unreliable nature of the world, samsara. Really, unreliable is a good word for that. Nibbana cannot be reached by backing off from a direct confrontation with the unreliable world to lose oneself in a blissful oblivion to the world. The path to liberation is a path of understanding, of comprehension and transcendence, not of escapism or emotional self-indulgence. Freedom can only be attained by turning one's gaze towards samsara, this unreliable world, and scrutinizing it in all its starkness. The understanding of the conditioned is the way to the unconditioned. And again, this is just to repeat and end with that evocation I made earlier, that the dispassion, this pulling back from the world, this turning away from the conditioned, does not result in disconnection from the world. In fact, it seems to create more connection. The heart that has released greed, aversion, and delusion is more open, more connected, more resonant. I sometimes feel like it's like, you know, a bowl of jello, you know, this heart that when it feels more open and receptive, you know, it vibrates. At least a little kind of jiggle of the table and the whole bowl of jello is going to vibrate. It's like the least little action of suffering, of happiness, of joy, of delight, and that heart is just responding to it. And that responsive heart, when there is suffering in the world, wants to respond. Not from constriction, but from connection. And when there's joy in the world, that open, resonant heart rejoices. So absence of desire, absence of greed, aversion, and delusion does not mean absence of feeling. The greed, the aversion, the delusion can't fathom any other feeling than themselves. But when, as they fall away, a different heart, a different experience of the heart is revealed. So let's sit for a moment.